Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Happy to have you with us today as we take a look at what the flooding and record-breaking rain and other kinds of bad weather have done to our gardens. Diana Offuth is back with us, and she's with us from our studios in Eau Claire. She's a UW Extension horticulture educator for Pierce County, also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls, and we'll talk about what to do for waterlogged plants and soil, and we'll take a look at what you should be doing in your garden at this time of year as well. So all kinds of general questions in addition. And of course, you can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's the one way to do it. The other way is to email us at ideas@wpr.org. Diana Offuth, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Great to be here, Larry. Thanks for having me.
How's your garden look? Is it all wet?
My garden's kind of weedy.
You didn't get as much rain in that part of the state, I don't believe.
Well, we did. We got a chunk on two. It rained like all day. So okay. A lot of the spots around us, we got 3 to 4 to 5 inches in places, but we didn't have the widespread flooding that was farther south last week.
Well, in addition to just swamping the plants, what kinds of things should be considering or worried about when it comes to our gardens, those that got so wet?
Well, the biggest thing is, did you actually have floodwaters run through your garden, through your vegetable garden? Because that can affect the safety of the produce.
Yeah.
So if you had running water run through your garden versus just, you know, rain falling for hours and hours and hours, then you have some concerns because you don't know where that floodwater came from. And it can be bringing all kinds of contaminants. And that's part of it is if you live near an industrial area where maybe there's some industrial contaminants, that's one thing. The other thing that we're worried about are bacteria that can cause foodborne illness. So if you had flood water actually run through your garden, anything that is eaten raw, like lettuce or spinach,
yeah,
or things like
don't
that,
do that,
you just don't want to eat at all. You that's just gone. Ripe tomatoes, if the tomatoes are orange already, you don't want to eat those probably at all, but at least not raw. Maybe if you were going to, you know, cook them down for 3 hours into spaghetti sauce or something, that would kill the bacterial issues, but that doesn't do anything if you had industrial contaminants come through,
yeah,
chemicals and stuff like that. If it's something like winter squash, then that's probably going to be okay because that rind protects it somewhat, but that's not something we eat raw usually. You cook that too, so the cooking would kill any kind of bacteria. So something like that would be all right. If you had tomatoes, green tomatoes that were above the floodwaters that didn't get actually flooded, it's going to be several weeks yet before you harvest those. That's going to help with that, but maybe you're still going to want to cook them rather than eat them fresh. Underground things like potatoes, if you're 3 or 4 weeks out yet before you're going to harvest those, they should be all right. But really, you have to ask yourself how much it got, if it got exposed to the water, what chances are there that that bacteria and those,
yeah,
foodborne illnesses are not fun to deal with, so you,
yeah,
don't want to take,
absolutely,
a chance with that. And we do have, UW Extension does have a fact sheet publication on safely using produce from flooded gardens. So I encourage everybody to just, you know, Google that, go to our horticulture website and get that. It'll have better guidelines on it. And then certainly, you know, the other thing is make sure that you don't feed anything that's even questionable to anybody who has, you know, a compromised immune system or
yeah,
at-risk population, that sort of thing.
You know, one other thing, and this is what I've observed in my own garden, you know, the tomatoes, they start to get ripe, and then they're just blistering open. You know, they're just...
Right. And I noticed that with mine. I had a variety of tomato that my master gardener has forced upon me this spring. It's called Big Zack. And this tomato is massive. You know, you need two hands to carry it. But boy, does it crack easily. And
yeah,
I went out to my garden after getting 3 inches of rain, and they're all just split wide open. And that, anytime that we get cracks on tomatoes, it's basically from from too much water getting forced into that fruit. So it's like a water balloon. If you put too much water in, it bursts. And so the best way to prevent that in normal years is to make sure that your tomatoes get even moisture throughout the year. So don't let them get too dried out, and then an inch thunderstorm automatically, you know, quickly puts a whole bunch more water in there, and that skin can't stretch, and so then they crack and they split. You know, cherry tomatoes are notorious for splitting. You can reduce that by getting varieties that are less susceptible to it, but also by trying to keep even moisture throughout the year. But, you know, when you get a 4-inch rain day, there's not much you can do about that. And so if you're out there and you are getting tomatoes that have cracked and split, that's why. And unfortunately, there's not much you can do about it.
Do you eat it?
You know, that's a really good question. I don't know what the official extension. To me, it's like if it looks like it just split, I would eat it. I might cut away that part of it. If it looks like it's been split for a couple of days and it's like sealing over, then I think, you know, who knows what got in there. And so then it's a little more risky. And hopefully you have lots of other tomatoes at this time of the season, so that if you have to discard a few, it's not that big of a loss. But, I'm not sure I'm officially answering that question.
Well, we have every one of our lines filled. Mary and Brandon had a weather-related issue. Let's go to her. Mary, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thank you. Our house and property was hit by a tornado a week ago, and we lost about 30, 40 trees. And in the process, I had two huge shade gardens, one with probably 60 hostas, bloodroot, ligularia, bleeding heart, Virginia bluebell, all in there, a stilbe. And what can I do with that? Is that all going to die? And secondly, if they can save the pine trees that are up the driveway, could I move that to that area that will still be shaded, even though it's been acidic for many years? And we lost 150-year-old oak trees.
I mean, I'm sorry.
That is so heartbreaking.
And then the second question is, the soil, we've had back holes in here and skid loaders. So there's all these, and they've been pulling these huge trunks of these trees. So the soil is compressed in many areas. What do I do about that? And what do I do with all these shade? Probably, I know, 60 to 100 shade plants. What do I do with them? Trillium, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, okay. Well, I am so sorry for you getting hit by that. That is just unimaginably disruptive.
And we had something like 19 tornadoes.
Yeah.
In the States. So you're not the only one, Mary, which is no consolation.
Right.
But
right. So thanks for calling in. So first, let's talk about the shade plants. You're right. They're going to fry in the direct sun. The good news is that it's not an urgent thing, because at this time of year, the sun is weaker, the days are shorter, and so it's not probably going to have a horrible impact on them right now. They're starting to even think about, you know, going dormant for winter and stuff. So it's not a hurry that you have to do anything with them. I don't think, you know, you might get some leaves that'll start scorching a little bit, but that's not going to hurt the roots. So I wouldn't panic about those. I think you've probably got other more pressing things to deal with right now. But next year when they come up and they're exposed to full sun, that's going to be a problem for some of them. There are some hostas that can handle quite a bit of sun. Typically, you're looking at, you know, whether or not they have more or less white on the leaves. That makes a difference, but it's not always, it doesn't apply to all the varieties, but you can be moving things in the spring. I don't know if you plan to like plant more trees to replace those that were lost and get some shade back in there. Obviously, that takes a while for them to grow up and provide the shade that you lost. So yes, you can transplant them by those pines. Usually, you know, when the evergreen needles decompose, they are acidic, but oftentimes that acid doesn't go down as far into the soil as you think because it stays up on the top surface. So what you might want to do to start out with is quick get a soil sample from that area and send it into the lab. You'll get your response in within a week probably at this time of year. And like I said, it's not a hurry that you have to move all of these things. And then you can see just how acidic that soil is 6 inches down where the roots of these plants will be. And that will tell you if you can, you know, if it's really out of whack, really acidic, well, then, you know, let's talk. But you might be able to amend it a little bit with putting some lime in there to get it back up, and then you can move those things. And you can move them later this year yet. You've still got time, or you can move them in the spring when things start growing up. The other thing that you can think of, if there's some plants that are not easy to move and you really would like them there, but you're hoping to put a tree back in there to eventually create some shade again, maybe you can do something temporary for a couple of years, like put up some trellising or something that'll give a little bit of shade. If you can put up an arbor and get a vine climbing up over that quickly, you know, some of those vines, like a grapevine or a the Engelmann ivy, the Virginia creeper vine and stuff, they grow very quickly and they can provide at least a little bit of shade for some plants that maybe you don't really want to move or you don't have room to move them to. So there's a couple of options there, but I don't think it's something that you have to deal with immediately. So I'd start with a soil test where if they can save those pines that you're talking about, start with a soil test there, see just what you're dealing with, and then you have probably, you know, up till Halloween before to be moving things. So
yeah.
First things first, worry about your tree removal. And then the second question about compacted soil, that is a concern. Once they're all done with it and things get smoothed back out, you'll have to kind of look at what's going to be there. So like if it's a lawn area, a grass area, and there's been a lot of heavy equipment over this wet soil, it will really, really get compacted. So you might be able to help that with just some heavy-duty aerating. You might need to, if there's a really bad area where there are deep ruts and stuff like that, you might need to get that rototilled up and fluffed up and then smoothed out and reseeded or planted to whatever is going to go in there. That is a concern. You certainly don't want to have stuff compacted like cement and let that all dry out, because then you'll be dealing with that for a long time to come.
Yeah, lots to think about there, Mary. I hope that helps.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling.
Good luck.
Good luck. And like I said, with 19 tornadoes over a very short period of time there are lots of people that have that issue.
I will tell you, Larry, that I was in Madison on that day, and I last Tuesday, and I was coming back north, and what normally takes me 3.5 hours to get home took me 8, because I was sitting on the closed interstate, and I drove through some absolute torrential rains and saw a lot of trees down and things like that, too, and I know there were other areas that had even more wind damage and stuff, but it was a pretty nasty weather spell here for the state.
Well, I'll tell you one little story. I happened to have an empty 5-gallon pail out on the sort of the edge of the driveway, no trees or anything over it, and I just left it there to see how much water would collect. And that 5-gallon pail is about 1/2 inch from the top right now.
Oh my gosh!
Over the last couple of weeks.
Wow! Yeah. So. I know someone down in Adams County, I think, said they've had 19 inches of rain in the last 2 weeks.
Oh.
So that's a lot of rain. And that's the other thing that, you know, we talked about the garden produce and stuff. One thing that we might see, too, especially if you're in a lower area when you've gotten that much rain, is these are the conditions that are just perfect for root rot diseases to get in. So in your gardens, whether it's vegetables or ornamentals, if you've got a lower spot, if you've got waterlogged soil and the plants start to collapse in a week or two, you may very well have gotten a root rot in there that's rotting away the root of the plant or the crown of the plant, and that will, in most cases, kill a plant. So if, you know, anybody sees that happening and they're wondering what's happening to their plant, that might very well be it. That's our secondary thing that we have to be watching for now.
Ellen in Madison has something for us. Hi, Ellen. Thanks for calling.
Hi. We, over the summer, experienced what I now know to be brown rot or something. I can't remember the exact name of it, on our lawn. And we were told by our lawn folks that we could get a treatment for like $200. That it was, when you get up in the morning, you would see, when there was moisture, you would see little feathery spots on it. It's called...
a mold?
Brown
is it?
Patch.
I'm sorry?
Brown patch.
Brown patch.
Okay.
So I bought, I thought, I'm not spending $200, so I bought a Spectracide Immunox fungus, and it didn't touch it. And so now it's all dead, just dead. And I'm not sure if it'll come back in some fashion or whether we need to reseed or what should we do?
Yeah, so lawn diseases and in home settings are really kind of complicated. They're not that common, but in a year when you get a lot of rain or if somebody has an irrigation system that they're watering too frequently, you can get stuff in there. In most cases, fungicide treatments are difficult to be effective because it... The fungus will live on plant debris and usually our best recommendation is to change the conditions. Now, obviously, if it's raining every day, there's not a whole lot you can do about it. But if it's something where you've been watering your lawn and that's contributing to the problem, we usually try to say, you know, let's turn the sprinkler off, let's let things dry out, and then the conditions aren't right for these lawn diseases to take hold, and they usually kind of just disappear. So, you know, going into winter here, if you've got a dead spot where you've got bare soil and the grass is gone, it's not going to obviously come back without reseeding. So, putting some grass seed in there, you could probably still do it this year.
I can still do it. I think do it right away.
If you're in the southern part of the state, you can. Usually, you know, we look at mid-August as the best time to be seeding grass, but you can still put some grass seed down on there and get it some roots before going into winter. And then, obviously, we kind of hope that it stops raining all the time. Like I said, a lot of times these things just go away on their own, and fungicide treatments are really difficult
to work
and be effective. You know, these fungal spores are blown around in the wind all the time, and they just need conditions to be right for them to take hold. So if we can change the conditions, get things dried out, in most cases it's the goal, they tend to go away. You know, other good lawn care management practices are important too. So mowing high or fertilizing at least once a year to keep your grass healthy. Those things are all important as well to keep your plants strong, and then they can, you know, defend themselves against some of these things. But I'd maybe just try to let it go.
Yeah, there you go. Diana Alfeth, our guest today. She is UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County, also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. Dave Potratz, our engineer, Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Diana Alfeth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Great to have her along. Thanks for listening. Give a call with your questions at 1-800-642-1234. And let's turn to Cheryl in Milwaukee next. Hi, Cheryl.
Hi. Thanks for having me. I was wondering, I have a question about putting up some security bushes in my backyard.
Okay.
Oh, you can hear me. Okay. I've been wanting to do it for a long time, and I know, you know, they get kind of expensive, so I've had to really be working and save up. But is there a special time of the year or the season that is better to plantos, like if I go get some like this next week and I start to put them in, am I going to have trouble with them in the fall, or is this a good planting time now?
Okay, so when you say security bushes, you mean like some screening to block view coming in, or?
Yeah, because I'm on an alley, and I'm trying to, they call it put them on a diagonal, kind of intertwine them and get them to be sort of
staggered in a, like two rows staggered.
Yeah. Yep.
Did you have exactly. an idea of the plants you were going to use?
Exactly. Well, I'm pretty sure it's going to be one of the windproof type that'll take to the wind pretty good.
Like an evergreen? Are you thinking like an arborvitae or a juniper or something like that?
Yes.
Okay.
Something
yep.
like that.
Yep.
Yep.
yep. Yep. So you can still plant those now. Absolutely. What we want to do when we plant, coming in this time of year is a great time to be planting things. And boy, the nurseries have some great sales on. So it's a good time to be filling in those holes and planting things. And you can, especially in Milwaukee, you can definitely be planting those yet. We just want the soil to be warm for about a month after they get in so that the roots can start developing a little bit. Make sure that when you plant them, you water them in well, and then you keep them well watered right up until the ground freezes. And when I say well watered, I don't want you to overwater them, so you don't water them every day. But depending on your soil, if you have sandy soil, maybe you water them every 3 or 4 days. If you have a heavier soil, maybe you water them every 4 to 5 days. Unless we get rain, then you let Mother Nature do the watering. So kind of stick your finger in the soil, and if it's dry, half inch down, you can go ahead and water them. You want to make sure that they're well hydrated going into winter because, of course, once the ground freezes, that evergreen foliage is out there losing moisture in the winter, but the plants can't take any more up because the ground is frozen. So make sure that they're well watered going into winter, and you should, then they'll take off really nice in the springtime. So in Milwaukee, man, I bet you could be planting till probably mid-October even.
Yeah. So you got
time. Yeah, up here we usually look at, end of September as our cutoff for evergreens. And anything deciduous, you can plant pretty much right up until the ground freezes. You can get it into the ground. So you've got time and get them going. So
there you go. And thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Kate Archer Kent sent us a little email, a reminder on that publication. There's one called Safely Using Produce from Flooded Gardens by
yep.
Barb Ingham and Steve Ingham.
Right. That's one of our horticulture garden fact sheets, and it's a nice two-page little thing that gives you everything you need to know.
And Rick in Eau Claire emailed to ask if you can help him with some suggestions for furthering his landscape design education. He can't attend a place of higher education due to having to work and provide for his family. Do you have a good accredited online school that you know about?
Interesting. I don't know off the top of my head, but if you search out things like Cornell University and Michigan State, they seem to have a lot of online classes that you can do. Another thing, depending on how seriously you want to get into this, another thing that you should check out is the University of Minnesota. They have a SULIS, S-U-L-I-S website, and that stands for Sustainable Urban Landscape Information Series, I think. And there is a section on there on landscape design, and it's quite extensive that you go through, and it talks about a lot of everything from the overall plan to combining plants. And so that might be something to check out to
as
get
well.
Started as well.
Okay.
So those are my best suggestions off the top of my head.
All right. Connie in Portage, will you turn to you next? Hi, Connie.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a gardenia tree, and it's leafed out just beautiful, but no flowers. Flowers this year. And I'm wondering what I've done wrong. I don't fertilize it, and maybe I should.
Has it flowered in the past?
Yes, all over, gardenias everywhere last year, and I have it right on the south side of the house, the same place.
Well, there could be a variety of things that went on. So if it's flowered in the past and it's on the south side and it's still in full sun, that's not the issue. But we had such a funky winter last year.
And spring, too.
The late part in April when we had all that really below average temperatures and stuff. And so the flower buds or the tissues that would form the flower buds and stuff may have been damaged. We've had a wide variety of things that have happened this year that are basically due to that winter injury. So the other thing that can affect almost all flowering plants is temperatures once the flower buds are forming. So it's possible that we got one of those super hot spells or a cold spell when those buds were supposedly forming and they aborted the flowers. If it didn't bloom at all year, I'm going to lean more towards maybe some winter injury. There might have been some damage to the vascular system of the plant that just stressed it enough that it's been spending its energy recovering from that rather than sending up flowers. I guess for 1 year without flowers, I'm going to blame it on the weather.
Yeah.
And when in doubt, blame it on the weather. And just see what happens next year.
Yeah.
Because it very well may do just fine next year. And if it doesn't, then we should talk and start looking further. But
I think you're absolutely right, Diana. Connie, hang in there, and I think next year you're going to get some flowers again.
And they smell great, don't they? Gardenias are beautiful.
Yeah,
smelling.
They're great. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Arshan and Beaver Dam, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. I'm ringing to ask if I need to get my potatoes out of the ground while the ground is so wet. And I have a second question. Is it too early to transplant hostas?
Is your soil kind of like really waterlogged? Is there still water there, or is your soil drying as we speak?
I think it's drying as we speak.
Yeah. So if it was like in waterlogged and it's still soupy and stuff, well, then those tubers could very well start rotting and that kind of thing. But if it's drying out, if your soil's well drained enough that even though it got soaked, it's drying out, they really should be okay and it's not a super, super hurry. But you might just kind of act like a gopher and dig down under there and find one or two and see what condition they are. If the soil isn't like wring out wet and, everything looks fine, then you can leave them in there longer, and it's not a hurry to get them out.
There you go.
And what was the second question?
Oh, what was the second one, Arshan?
Transplanting hostas.
Yeah.
I think you can start transplanting hosta right now.
Yeah.
Again, the days are shorter. They're not so hot. And go ahead and transplant them. Any foliage that goes along with them will probably kind of get all dramatic and wilt and that kind of a thing. But, you can trim them back a little bit, but I wouldn't overly trim them back because they're still going to be doing photosynthesis and stuff. As long as they are watered well going, once they get moved, so that those roots can get reestablished, they should be fine.
And Arshan, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. John in Union Center, we turn to you next. Hi, John.
Good afternoon. Yes, I have planted two apple trees in my yard, and the beetles got after them really bad, and I sprayed them. And they say you're not supposed to spray them every 11 days, but boy, them beetles really tore them up.
The Japanese beetles?
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah, that ate all the leaves and just left the veins behind. And these were newly planted this year?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So there's nothing you can really do about it at this point. Typically, the Japanese beetles eat the leaf tissue, but they don't really hurt the tree overall. Hopefully there were still a few leaves or parts of leaves left behind to do photosynthesis and create energy for the tree, that sort of a thing. So if you lost like a third of the leaf tissue, that's probably not going to affect the trees much at all. But young trees that are first established, they, you know, don't have a lot of leaves and they need to be growing a lot of roots and everything. So you don't want that to happen again next year. So if they're small trees, one of the things that you might consider is getting floating row cover. It's usually used to cover vegetables and stuff, but it comes in different sizes. And you can kind of create like a little net, and you can actually put it over that little apple tree starting middle to end of June before those Japanese beetles come out. And the sunlight goes through them, the air goes through them, all that sort of thing. But the beetles don't go through it. And so they can't access those leaves and chew them up. How bad of a season we'll have for Japanese beetles next year, we don't know. There's a lot of factors that are involved with that. But to protect a young tree like that, you might consider just that physical barrier, and then you don't have to worry about spraying, because, you know, spraying is expensive and time consuming and not, you don't get them all anyway. So, if the tree's small enough to cover it, and it's something that obviously you want to make sure the wind doesn't take it off, but you don't have to, like, totally secured around the bottom, because the Japanese beetles come from above and they land on it. So if you can just get it draped over that foliage stuff, kind of loosely tied around the trunk maybe, and just create a little bubble for that tree, that might be a good idea.
There you go, John. Thank you for calling. Marit in Madison, your turn.
Yeah, hi. I was just wondering if you can plant ferns in the fall.
So, yes. Like, transplant them? Sure, you can. Yep. You know, we are going into the best time of season for transplanting things. And, again, what we want to make sure is that the roots have a little bit of time to get established before winter. And we want to make sure, no matter how big of a hole you dig, you always leave some roots behind and break off some roots and things. So you want to make sure that they get watered well. But because the sun is getting less hot and the days are getting shorter, it's a beautiful time to start transplanting things. I have this big long list at home of things I have to I have to transplant that I've been looking at all summer, that it's like, that needs to go, that needs to be expanded, that needs to be divided, and now's the time to do it. So you can do just about everything. You know, there are a few things like peonies that don't like to be moved at all, and maybe they're best done in springtime.
What about daylilies?
Anytime. In fact, okay, so I probably shouldn't say this, because the best time to transplant things are spring and fall. But if you're in a pinch and it's July and you have to move something because you have a construction project or something like that, you can move things in the heat of the summer. They will get dramatic. They'll droop down. They're not going to look pretty that year. But as long as you water them well, they most often survive, especially daylilies, because they are very hardy.
Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And speaking of emails, Kate emailed and sent a couple of photos along. She planted dahlias this spring in exactly the same way and right next to each other. And she's got two pictures. One is giant and full of blooms. The other is about a quarter of the size. It's bushy, and it's not blooming. And she wants to know what the heck happened. And, you know, there's any number of things that, you know, maybe there's a rock right underneath the one.
Yeah, that is hard. There might have been maybe some insect larva got into the bulb and chewed on it some and stressed it some. There may have been some other kind of insect thing that bothered it earlier on in the year, even, you know, some kind of mites and stuff that you don't see well. So you're right, Larry. There may be something that compromised that root system and it never got as big. There's also, I don't know how susceptible they are to viruses and stuff, but there may be something like that that got into it.
But they're right next to each other. So if it had gotten one, it would have gotten the other, I would have thought.
Well, a virus, though, is spread typically by insects, like a leaf hopper. And so that leaf hopper might have landed on the one plant and not the other, because that's not a wind-borne thing. That has to be transmitted by an insect. So that's happened. I mean, even like aster yellows, a lot of people know what aster yellows is. It affects the purple coneflowers. And that, again, is transplanted by a leafhopper. So you'll have a big patch of coneflowers, and one or two of them will have aster yellows, and the others don't. So it's really kind of hard to say. And I don't know if they're different varieties either, that maybe there was some difference
same
there.
Ones.
Yeah.
She leave them there and see what happens next year?
Yeah, well, and if they're dahlias, they're likely to be dug up for the...
Yeah.
To overwinter inside. So I would keep those bulbs separate and mark them, because if there is a virus in it, it's going to do the same thing next year. And then you know that it's not worth digging up and saving because it's never going to bloom.
There we go. And thanks for that email. Let's go to Jill in Marshfield next. Hi, Jill.
Hi. Probably about May, end of May, I bought a lilac bush that was in a pot, probably a 12-inch pot, from another gardener. And I haven't planted it yet. I live in Wood County. I've got a very shady yard, and my two questions in particular are, how much sun does it need? And I have a very old row of honeysuckle bushes. I mean, they're over 20 years old. Could I incorporate it into one of those spots where I need to take a honeysuckle out?
You said this was a lilac?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay, so lilacs like full sun. And full sun means at least 6 hours of midday direct sun every day. So if you have a really shady yard, your lilac, the plant will grow, but it'll all be leaves and it isn't going to bloom very much. So that's your first consideration. If you've got honeysuckles, do the honeysuckles bloom every year?
Oh, God, yes.
Okay. Okay, so they can bloom in part shade and stuff, so they can handle more shade than lilacs will with blooming. But if you've got an area in that row that maybe gets more sun than others, you can definitely incorporate the lilac into that. They'll coexist just fine. But as far as how many flowers you're going to get, like I said, you need 6 hours of midday sun.
There you go. Thanks, Jill. Appreciate the call. And Dan in Caledonia, we'll go to you next. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Dan. Hey, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Here's what I'm asking. I've gotten interested in slack lining, which are like 2-inch wide nylon bands that you balance on.
Yeah.
And with some of the kits, they come with tree protectors, which are sort of padded under the actually, you cinch these up between two trees. And then work on the balance. But I'm wondering, if they come with tree protectors, is it likely, if you're not using them, you're going to damage the plants, the trees? Even if you are using them, I've got like 30, 35-year-old plus silver maples in the yard that I'd be putting them between. And you'd put them up for, 20, 30 minutes, 5 minutes until I fall off. And, but, using them occasionally like that on trees, would you see any potential damage if it wasn't left on for a long period of time? And
yeah.
Okay. Well, this is new. I would love to watch you slackline, and that would be interesting to see. I've not seen that in person. So it kind of depends on these tree protectors and how what they are. So if it's like a wide strap, a couple inches wide, and that would go around the tree, and then I'm guessing your line gets attached to that, so it's the pressure is holding it on there, then it likely wouldn't cause any major damage to an older tree like that, because that tree's bark is going to be pretty thick, okay? So it might, maybe just scuff the surface a little bit, But that wouldn't do any damage. If it's anything that you start pounding into the tree or anything like that, well, that's another issue, because then you're creating a wound in that tree. You're damaging the vascular system and that sort of a thing. If the tree protector thing is narrow like a rope, that's more likely to cut into the bark because there's less surface area there, so more pressure. So it kind of depends on how that goes. Yeah. But if you're putting it on just for, half an hour until you fall off enough times, that's not going to be a problem because it's not going to constrict the
tree at all.
Right. But it would just be sure that it's not digging deep down into that bark.
There you go, Dan. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Diana Alfeth, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guest, Diana Alfeth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Questions for her? Give a call. His open lines get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And Diana, we're going to take a call from Rosie in Nakusa next. Hi, Rosie.
Hi, Larry. I'm just wondering, we have a lot of rhubarb. And we put up a shed, so now it is shaded an awful lot, and we want to transplant it. Is it okay to transplant it in the fall?
Yes, you can. So rhubarb really can be transplanted either in the early spring or the early fall, so mid-September to early October. And you're right, it wants full sun to do its best. And so when you transplant it, it also likes fertile soil. So if you can work in a bunch of organic matter, some composted manure or something like that with that soil, that'll get it off to a good start. And then just keep it well watered until it goes dormant for the year.
Go for it, Rosie. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we've got lots of things to talk about here and lots of callers online. You can join in, though, at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Give a call with your questions. Sue in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a Japanese maple, and I'm wondering, is it important that has a leader? I have one of the side branches that actually is a little taller and a little more dominant than what should be the leader. Is that important with it?
Well, it kind of depends on what you like to look at. So as far as the health of the tree goes, what we worry about when you start getting side branches and things is that as that tree gets bigger and bigger, will it split? Okay, so if you have narrow crotch angles, so like a real narrow V shape between the branches, every year both of those branches get a little fatter, a little fatter, a little fatter. The bark in between will get squeezed in between, and then they get weaker. So Japanese beetles aren't, or Japanese maples, Japanese beetles have been talked about a lot this year, right? Japanese maples don't get really big, they're not like the super bigger trees and stuff. So you have less of a concern with that, but that's really what you need to worry about from the health of the tree standpoint. Otherwise, if you, you can make a Japanese maple look like a shrub if you want to prune it that way and have more of a shrub form rather than a tree form. So,
kind of up to you, I guess.
Right, Sue. Right. So it kind of, you need to look at, is that branch structure ever going to cause a problem? And then you have to look at, is this the form that I want to look at and make the decision that way.
There you go. Thank you so much. Dan in Eau Claire, on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. I have a quick question regarding maple tree seedlings. I usually plant a half a dozen or so every year, and by the end of the summer, they're doing pretty well, but they seem to have a hard time making it through the winter. Should I be doing some type of light fertilizing in the fall on those, or is that too soon to do that?
Usually we say that a tree should be in place for one grow 1 year before you fertilize. So if they're just dying, if they're not making it, it's probably not a fertility issue, because there's probably, you know, Wisconsin, we have fertile soils and stuff, at least enough that it would survive. Okay. So I doubt that it's a fertilizer issue. So if they're not making it, it could be just, you know, winter cold. It could be not enough moisture going into winter so that they dry out. It could be something else along the lines of, you know, something else gets to them, like deer or rabbits or stuff like that. So fertilizing in the fall, we don't want to fertilize like too early in the fall, because sometimes that affects trees and shrubs' ability to harden off good for winter. So we want that fertilizer there when they are putting on a lot of their growth, which would be next spring. So if you put fertilizer on this fall, I would want you to do it after that plant's pretty much gone dormant for the year. You know, the leaves have fallen off and stuff. Otherwise, put it on early in the spring. And if you transplanted stuff, or if you planted these last spring, then this spring would be the time for them to get a dose of fertilizer. But if they're not making it through the winter, it's probably not a fertilizer thing. It's something else going on.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Dan, for calling. Appreciate it. And Mary in Marshfield, your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hello, good morning. I wanted to, since we're talking about fall transplanting of perennials, I wanted to tell your listening audience that Wood County Master Gardeners is having their fall plant sale on September 15th and 16th from 9 to 4 at Wildwood Park in Marshfield. It's in conjunction with the Maple Fall Fest celebration. We'll have a large selection of native prairie plants and plants from our local gardeners. We're going to be talking especially about pollinators this year and plants you can put in the ground for those. We'll have selection of ground covers. Usually we have a lot of hostas and daylilies. We have one member who is a aficionado of daylilies, so she has a large selection. And so we just wanted to tell you about that.
All right, the 15th and the 16th, and where is it in Marshfield, Mary?
It's at the Wildwood Park, and it's in conjunction with Maple Fall Fest, so there will be cars all around. And then we're close to, we're by the fence where you go into the zoo area.
All right, well...
That's a great idea. And again, you know, I know what holes are in my garden and what needs something now, but I don't always remember that come spring. So so getting some plants and getting them in this fall is really a great idea. So take advantage of that, and I'm sure the proceeds go to good cause.
Absolutely. And the Master Gardeners are wonderful people. Let's support them for sure. Thanks, Mary. Appreciate it. Jeremy in Eau Claire, your turn. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, Larry. I had a question about a hibiscus plant that I was given as a gift from my in-laws. They planted it on the south side of our house, right up against the house, and it's beautiful. And I want to keep it alive, and I don't really know much about gardening, to be honest. So I didn't know if there was something I needed to do with it in the winter to keep it alive.
Where do you live again?
Eau Claire. Eau Claire.
Okay. Okay. So the hibiscus are... They're hardy, but they're kind of on the edge sometimes, depending on our, you know, what kind of winter weather we get and stuff. The newer ones, hopefully, whatever variety you got is one of the newer ones that are a little more winter hardy. So you really shouldn't have to do too much with it. Some people will put a little more mulch over it after it dies back, just to kind of protect that root system in case we don't get a lot of snow cover or something like that. But the big thing is just, again, making sure that it's well watered, but not overwatered going into the winter. If you do put any mulch over it, don't do that until the ground freezes a little bit. So you want like an inch of frost in the ground before you put any kind of mulch, like some straw or leaves or evergreen boughs or something over it. We're not trying to keep the ground from freezing. We're actually trying to keep it frozen once it freezes. And that protects the plant from going through freeze-thaw cycles, especially in spring, because that's what usually does them in, because they are breaking dormancy either too early and then they get cold or they heave up out of the ground or something like that. So then if you do put any kind of mulch over it, come April, scrape that off, and then things should be okay. Just remember that hibiscus a lot of times seem to get a late start, so other things will be up and growing and you'll be wondering where your hibiscus is. And don't panic, because they sometimes sprout up a little bit later in our area, depending on the variety and stuff. So
there you go.
So,
and it's next to the house, so that is probably a good thing. I've got a few things planted next to my house that shouldn't survive the winters.
Yeah,
but you know what? They do.
And sometimes that's a double-edged sword, though, because next to that house, especially if it's on a south side, that might warm up faster in the spring.
Ah.
And so then that causes things to break dormancy and start growing. But then we get, like last April, 10 degrees, and then that shuts them back down. And that's why mulching it to keep it dormant longer is sometimes helpful.
It is sometimes very helpful. Well, our guest today, Diana Alfuth, is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. Always a lot of fun to talk with her on Garden Talk, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Diana Alfuth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Always great to have her come by. And certainly if you have a question for her, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have open lines, get you on pretty quickly. Becky and Eau Claire, it's your turn. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. I'm having a problem for the last few years in the fall, especially after a rain, late summer and fall, getting these really gross mushrooms all over my yard. Well, not all over. They're like really clumpy looking, and then they have a bright yellow bottom.
Yeah.
Somebody said something to me about maybe it's connected to ash trees or something.
Yeah. So there are lots of mushrooms in the lawns and stuff right now. And sometimes you'll see like a ring of darker green in your grass. And then the mushrooms are growing around that ring. And fairy rings. So it's pretty impossible to say exactly, what kind of mushroom it is. But what they're doing is these are the fruiting bodies of a fungus that's living on organic matter down in the soil. So that organic matter could be a dead tree root of any kind. It's not just associated with ash. But if you had an ash tree die, or if you had a tree taken out of your yard, remember that tree roots grow outward 2 to 3 times the height of a tree. So if you had a tree die and you're getting mushrooms 100 feet away, if that was a 50-foot tree, it may very well be living on those dying, decaying tree roots underground. Some of these fungi will live on dying on organic matter like dead grass roots and other things that are decaying in the soil. So they're perfectly harmless to the grass in most cases, although like the fairy ring, sometimes what causes the green ring is that as that fungus is growing out from a center spot and it's decaying, this organic matter, it releases nitrogen, and that's what makes that darker green ring. And if you, you know, every now and then you might get a little dead spot within that. But it's harmless to the grass. It's harmless to us. I mean, obviously, we don't want to eat them. We don't want dogs eating them. We don't want kids playing with them or anything like that. And there's nothing you can do about it because you can't, like, fumigate your soil with a fungicide to kill all of this. And not that you would want to anyway. And they'll just run their course. It's just, you know, it's the time in that fungus's life cycle to send up the mushrooms, send out spores, reproduce. And if you just kind of rake them up and discard them, the whole problem will just kind of disappear. But it is very common for that to happen in the fall.
I just run over them with a lawnmower.
Yep, and they stick in the treads on the tire, and
yes.
And they get scattered about, and just don't. It's slipperier than a banana peel, though, so be careful.
Be careful out there, Becky. Thank you for calling. Judy in Delafield, hi.
Hi, I have a question about false indigo. I have a huge plant, and it needs to be divided or taken out, and I don't know when is the best time to do it. And I understand they have a taproot, so I'm not sure how I go about that.
Yeah, they look like big bushes, so we a lot of times we think of them as more of a woody plant, but they are a native prairie plant. They have a fibrous root system, and they do have big roots, though, and they need big roots to create such a large plant. But now's a great time to do it. Our general rule is that if something blooms in the spring, it's best divided in the fall. If something blooms in summer or later in the year, it's best to divide it in the spring. And false blue, or, you know, the false indigo, the Baptisia, blooms kind of early in the year, so it might be a little bit better to do it now in the fall, but you could do it in the early spring as well. And it will be, you know, an effort to dig that root system out of there, but they're pretty resilient too, so you can dig that root ball up, you can stomp on your spade and divide it into smaller chunks and then replant those. And again, just make sure it's watered in well and it'll be fine.
There you go. Thank you so much for calling. Andy in Eau Claire emailed to ask what he should do with the potting soil from the potted tomatoes that had early blight. He doesn't think his compost pile gets hot enough to kill the early blight.
Okay. So that is, if you got the early blight in there, that does overwinter and survive in the soil and plant debris in the soil. So if you use it again, it could splash up and create problems for your tomatoes next year. So putting it on a compost pile, nah, probably not the greatest idea to do if it doesn't heat up a lot. But you can do anything else with it. Early blight just really affects tomatoes for the most part. So if you have a shrub bed or something like that and you want to just dump it in with, you know, in there and that kind of thing, that's fine. Like I said, it's not something that affects a lot of our other plants. And you could use it and plant something else in those containers next year, like beans or lettuce. And
sure,
those pathogens, you know, don't affect those plants. So
just leave it in the pots.
Then. Yeah, and plant flowers next year.
There you go.
Cucumbers.
Yeah, why not?
Mm-hmm.
Jan and Osseo, your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
See, I got a question. I got a small cottonwood tree, you know, like only about 4 foot diameter, and it got hit by lightning, and it actually makes a streak up the tree. Oh, I'd say it goes up about 30 feet, and then about 20 where the branches actually start to split, I can see about a quarter inch crack up in that area. I'm wondering, is there some, and it's starting, and that was like last week, and it's starting to lose leaves. They're a little bit turning yellow right now. I'm wondering, is there something I could do to maybe, that's a huge tree to fertilize, but I've got some, I'm on a farm, I could put some stuff around it. Is there something I should do to help maybe water it or something that give it a chance?
Sure. So only the tree knows how bad the damage is. And so the fact that the leaves are yellowing isn't a good indication because right now we are getting into fall. So on cottonwoods and popples and stuff, some of those leaves are starting to kind of go off color already. Add to that all that electricity that shot through that tree, and that's probably causing some stress there. Fertilizer does not help. We don't want to fertilize stressed trees because the tree has to do its own recovering. And when we fertilize, that usually forces more top growth and leaf growth and stuff. And so I'm sure there's plenty of fertility in that ground, especially on a tree that size. As far as the split goes, there's nothing you can do about it. Don't go cabling it together or filling it with cement or anything like that. Only time will tell on how bad that damage is and what will happen with that tree. Like I said, we don't know how bad the vascular system was affected. The best thing that you can do is, like you said, if we get into a dry spell, water the tree so that it doesn't get into any more stress, and then just see what happens. Next year, you'll know what happened.
There you go.
But nothing you can do about it.
Thank you, Jan. Appreciate it. Nancy in Rice Lake, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. I have a question about a hydrangea bush. I have a hydrangea bush that is beautiful. It's very full and lush. However, it never gets any flowers. Now, I am cutting it back in the fall, and I'm wondering if that has something to do with it.
It could. Do you know what kind of hydrangea it is?
No, I don't. I don't.
Okay. So depending on what kind it is, there are some that bloom on old wood and some that bloom on new wood. And some of those that die back all the way to the ground on their own, well, they have to bloom on new wood. How much sunlight does it get?
It's not in shade. It probably, by direct sunlight?
Right.
Yep.
Oh, probably 3-4 hours.
Okay. So that should be enough to trigger at least some blooms. Again, depending on the variety. I would not prune it. Since we don't know what the variety is, it's hard to say for sure what's going on. There are some varieties that just aren't winter hardy, so they just aren't going to bloom because they're getting too stressed in winter. If you're pruning it back, I would say to not prune it back for a year and see what happens. Because if it's one that needs to bloom on old wood and you're pruning that away, that could be the problem. So try not pruning it this year and see if you get any flowers next year.
Yeah, and don't prune it in the spring either, at least next spring.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
There you go. Hi, Nancy, thank you so much. And hi to another Nancy, this one from Grafton. Hi.
Well, hello. Are you there?
Yeah, what can we do for you?
Okay, we had one of that strong straight-line wind that came through our village here, and we had a lot of trees that were planted between the curb and the sidewalk, and these trees were blowing completely right out of the ground, and, you got that big mound of ground, but all the roots came right out with the trees, and a lot of damage done. So what kind of tree would be the best to replant in that kind of an area? Because we have to replant. It doesn't look so good without all those trees.
Yeah.
It does change things, doesn't it?
One thing I would just say overall, make sure that you're not planting all the same trees.
Yes.
There should be a variety of trees planted.
Right. And that would be the start of my answer, is look at which trees did survive and what's in the yards and stuff as well. If you've got all maples in the yards, then don't add more maples back in the boulevard area there, because, we have emerald ash borer, we have Dutch elm disease, and who knows what will come next. And so we want to make sure we have a variety of trees. The other thing that you have to look at is how much space is there. So we don't want to put a massive, massive tree there that is never going to be able to grow to its full maturity because of power lines or buildings or impeding traffic, that sort of thing. So, and then, of course, we have to look at soil conditions as well. So what you're seeing here is there's no easy answer, right? But think of things that maybe you don't need massive big trees there. So you could look at things like crab apples or honey locust. Honey locust is one that's good for, you know, there's a restricted root zone there because there's a road on one side and a sidewalk on another side. So those trees, don't have a lot of space to grow out roots. So something that's a little bit smaller in some of these places might be a good consideration.
You know what I'd put in front of my house, Nancy, if I were you? And maybe Diana's going to say, no, don't do it. But, I've got a Japanese lilac tree.
Uh-huh.
And it smells so good, the flowers.
Yeah.
And it's in a spot kind of like that where it's got a sidewalk on one side and then the house kind of is on the other side. So it's in a tight spot and it's still growing quite well and it really flowers well.
Yep, that's a good choice to put some of those kinds of things in there. Certainly you can do some maples if you don't have an overabundance of maples. Hackberry is another tree that's, gets a little bit bigger, but it can handle urban conditions really well. If it's an area that you've got a lot of room, you can look at Kentucky coffee tree, but that gets to be a big, big tree when it gets mature, so you got to make sure that there's enough space for it that way. There are also some of the new hybrid elms that are resistant to Dutch elm disease that are worth a try. And again, the key is to get a variety of things in there. Don't, we kind of like this thing of, everything's all uniform and it, we create that tunnel of everything looking the same, but that's not good because as you see, one well-placed funnel cloud can wipe out that uniform look anyway. So let's go for variety. But if you want to, we could talk more about the specific conditions and soil conditions and stuff like that to give you a better idea of what to plant. But
I think those were all good ideas. Nancy, does that help out?
Well, sure. And I wrote all those little notes down here. And my son works at a village here in Grafton, so I will hand over the education that I just received.
Oh, yeah. Right. Tell him be sure not to plant all the same because we've got all kinds of communities that used to have elms, and they're gone. And now we've got a lot of communities with ash trees everywhere, and now a lot of those are gone.
Yeah. And, what's going to be bad is when the emerald maple borer moves in or something.
Something else, yeah.
We're going to be in big trouble then.
Thanks, Nancy. Appreciate it. Well, let's go on to Lee in Green Bay.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Hi, Lee.
Hi there. Your previous caller lady mentioned honeysuckle, and I just kind of wanted to make a comment so your listeners know the common honeysuckle, the best thing to do with them is cut them off at ground level.
Yep.
Hit that stump with herbicide because they're so invasive.
Yep. That is absolutely true. And the Tatarian honeysuckle is like number two on the invasive species list for the state. And, they were originally planted as ornamentals. They smell great. They get the pretty berries on them and stuff. But you're right. They are an invasive species. And so it is something that we don't plant anymore. But I think she said hers were like 30 years old. And so...
There you go. Good point, Lee. Thank you for calling. And Mark in Waukesha. Hello, Mark. Yes. Thanks for calling.
Hey, good afternoon, Larry and Diane. Thank you for the show. My question is about a newly planted, I believe it's a Causa dogwood, planted in mid-April, about 7 feet tall. And on the recommendation of the nursery, the gentleman suggested that I use Miracid as a fertilizer because it likes more acidic soils every 2 weeks or so. And by midsummer, I saw a lot of curling of the leaves, yellowing along the veins, browning at the tips. Went back to the same nursery for some more advice, and they suggested, different individuals suggested some ketylated iron treatments, that there may be too much acid there then and needed some iron. and a heavy phosphorus fertilizer. Now, I've done two treatments of the chelated iron a couple weeks apart, one application of the heavy phosphorus fertilizer, and I've gotten a lot of new lush green growth at the bottom of the tree. Unbeknownst to me, just because of timing of the events, I have a fertilizer, a tree fertilizer service. They hit that tree a couple days after I had used the heavy phosphorus fertilizer. My question then is, at what intervals and for how long should I continue any additional fertilizing to try to rejuvenate that tree as it goes into its first winter?
I would stop now.
Yeah, me too.
So I think the initial advice that you got to put muriacid on every 2 weeks was super, super excessive.
Yes.
When you're giving it that much nitrogen, I think that's what was causing the burning tips of the leaves and stuff like that, because it's just like if you, you know, have a fertilizer spill on your lawn and it burns it out and it kills it. I think you were probably over-fertilizing. We really, every 2 weeks with a liquid fertilizer is just way too much. The second thing is the high phosphorus fertilizer. I'm not going to recommend that to anybody without a soil test. So first you got to tell me, does your soil need fertile phosphorus? Because at that point, that tree was in the ground for a little while. And while phosphorus does help with initial root development, if you've already got a fair amount of phosphorus in your soil, adding more phosphorus is not going to have a huge benefit, and it's certainly not going to solve the symptoms that you were dealing with. Coosa dogwood does like a lower pH, down into the fives or so, but until you get a soil test to see what your pH is, you can't be adding muriacid or trying to acidify it or anything, because you have no idea if you're getting enough or too much or whatever. So my recommendation would be to stop doing anything to that tree right now. Let it stabilize itself and do a soil test. So get a soil sample from areas around that root zone. Send it into the soil lab in Marshfield right now. You'll get your results probably within a week to 10 days, and then you will know. You put right on that soil test when you send it in that you're trying to grow a Coosa dogwood tree, and they should give you recommendations for what you need to do. And then, you know, if you need to adjust that pH, I would say, you know, if you need to get that pH down significantly, you're going to be better off using sulfur rather than muriacid. And you're going to find out just how much phosphorus and potassium you have in that soil right now, so that you know if you need anything else along those lines.
There you go, Mark. Thank you so much for calling. Nikki in Waterford, we're running out of time here, so I'm just going to pass along that Nikki wanted to know if her dwarf cranberry loses all its leaves this time of year. Is that supposed to happen?
Well, it's, you know, if it does it every year, there dwarf cranberries, there's a few things. There are fungal diseases that get it. There's some mites that get on them. You might get, like, the leaves turning reddish or speckled or, you know, red spots or that sort of a thing. And so by this time of year, some of them can look kind of ratty. But they usually come back fine the next year, probably a combination. I'm going to lean mostly towards fungi if they're actually losing the leaves.
And one quick thing, Julie emailed to ask if she should cut her flowering plants before winter.
It all depends. So if we're talking like flowering perennials and stuff like that, you don't need to. It all depends on how neat you want it to look for the year. But I like to leave a lot of them up, especially if they have seed heads, because finches and other things eat them over the year. And so it kind of depends, too, on when you have time to do your garden cleanup. Sometimes I like to do things in the fall because I know I'm super busy in the spring. But, you know, as far as the health of the plant goes, there are a few of them that it's a good idea to cut them off. There are a few of them that if you cut them off, it's not good. But for generally, most of the time speaking, it's totally up to you.
Up to you. Diana, thanks so much. We'll look forward to your next visit. I really appreciate you taking the time. Thanks.
Always fun.
Diana Offuth, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County, our guest. She'll be back. We'll talk with her again. Next week on Garden Talk, Lisa Johnson joins us to talk about all kinds of things in the garden. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store.